You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, water towers have their functional purposes, but according to our guests, they have plenty more to offer, like hometown pride. We'll take a look at the towers dotting Wisconsin's landscape and what they say about the communities we live in. Now, President Biden focused much of his campaign in early days in office on taking a more humane approach to immigration. The bill he's proposed to Congress would create new pathways to citizenship, and his executive orders have undone some of the Trump administration's harsher immigration rules. But a new rise in migration at the U.S.-Mexico border is putting that approach to the test. This January, the rate of apprehensions near the border was more than double that of the same month last year, and the number of migrant children in U.S. custody has tripled in the past 2 weeks, now more than 3,000. Some responses from the Biden administration include reopening a temporary detention facility in Texas and waiving certain COVID-19 safety measures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family been affected by the immigration system now or in the past? What do you think the future of immigration policy should look like? Do you want to see Congress take up reforms to the system? And what questions do you have about the situation now at the southern border? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dara Lind is an immigration reporter for ProPublica. Dara, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back.
I just mentioned a couple of broad statistics there, but can you put us some context to the numbers for us and paint a picture of what's going on right now at the southern border?
Sure. So we actually we just got the numbers for February, which confirm the trend that you were just describing of what is, you know, certainly compared to the last few years, pretty unusually high levels of people getting arrested attempting to enter the United States. Now, there is something of an apples to oranges thing going on here, because one of the Trump administration policies that the Biden administration has not yet changed is what's called the Title 42 order, which was using a fairly obscure public health law to have the CDC issue a proclamation that anyone who was coming into the United States from Mexico could be carrying coronavirus and therefore needed to be expelled as quickly as possible. So they've been using that to prevent single adults and families from even trying to seek asylum in the United States and, you know, sending them back to Mexico or deporting them within a matter of hours. That does, especially for those sent back to Mexico, make it easier for them to try again. So we do know that a fairly substantial number of the of what are now being reported as 100,000 arrests in February, a substantial number of those were kind of repeats over the course of the month. So it is a little bit inflated compared to past years when recidivism was very low because it took a much longer time to process someone and they were getting deported a longer distance. But it is still fairly high, especially when you think about the fact that usually, you know, January, February is the beginning of an upward slope that culminates in May or June. And by those standards, this is higher even than 2019, when by April, May, June, there was just massive overcrowding in Border Patrol facilities. That's kind of the real reason that this is relevant, right? Especially because, you know, most people are still getting expelled. So they really only matter for the numbers for academic reasons. But for people who are being held in the U.S., the capacity is really an issue. And that's especially true for unaccompanied children who are not subject to that CDC order and who, as you may recall from previous immigration debates in 2014 and 2019, are statutorily supposed to have extra protections in the United States. So we're already at the point where Border Patrol custody, as you mentioned, of unaccompanied kids is up. Those kids are only supposed to be in Border Patrol custody for 72 hours at most. And children are, we're seeing reports that children are being held for days longer than that. And there's something of a problem with the facilities that are supposed to take them from Border Patrol, which are run by the Department of Health and Human Services, which had to restrict its capacity at its shelters for COVID reasons because it didn't want to operate at full capacity in, you know, congregate housing, which is known to be a big transmitter of the virus, and which has had to lift those capacity limits in order to accommodate the number of children that are getting taken in.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked last week about the administration's plans in regards to the accompanied minors you were just talking about and how many they were prepared to accept and house. Here's some of her response.
when these kids come in, it doesn't mean they are insured that they get to stay. They go through the processing system that everyone goes through. But we want to ensure that that is done by treating them humanely and with respect. Many of them will be sent back home eventually. But we're talking about how we treat them as they come in the country.
So, Dara, how are these kids being treated now in the country with, as you mentioned, the system for housing them while their fate is determined is overstressed?
There, the theory behind putting this under the responsibility of HHS instead of under the Department of Homeland Security is that this is supposed to be like more of a, you know, foster type environment. It's supposed to be more supportive environment, and it's supposed to be temporary, right? The purpose of these shelters is that HHS officials are tasked with finding essentially the closest relative in the United States, who is usually a pretty close relative, either a parent, uncle, grandparent, something like that, and placing the child with them as a sponsor. Those transfers have also been slowed down a little bit due to the coronavirus pandemic. But you know, that's the goal. The problem is that these are contracted out to other operators. And there's kind of a spectrum of those operators, with some of them, especially some of the facilities that opened during the Trump administration, taking much more of a juvenile detention style approach that was, you know, that was closer to ICE or Border Patrol detention than certainly many advocates would have liked. And so by trying to expand capacity quickly, the concerns that the Biden administration is running into is that they're leaning on some of the same facilities and some of the same contractors who have in the past been seen as overly punitive toward these migrant kids.
Now, there's been argument about what is driving people to come to the U.S. now, especially from Central America. Some arguments saying people are seeing that President Trump is out, President Biden is in, their chances are better of getting in. They think they'll be treated better. You also write about, though, the conditions in the countries of origin getting worse, especially with recent hurricanes on top of all the other issues, poverty and violence that were already driving people. What do we know about what's bringing people to the border now?
So I think we actually have to go back about a year, because the increase trend-wise actually dates from April of last year, April or May, because March and April was so incredibly, incredibly low in 2020 in terms of how many people were crossing into the United States, because that was the first real coronavirus, like worldwide lockdown, lots of travel restrictions in place. People were very worried, didn't really understand what was happening, didn't really know what came next. And so since then, we've seen a slow and then less slow increase in the number of people coming. And so, you know, so some of that is probably people who, you know, might have come a year ago, but were deterred then, and, you know, making plans now instead. And some of it is that, you know, Central America and Latin America more broadly, like anyone who's employed in the informal economy is really in trouble. The job loss is just catastrophic. They haven't been, you know, many of these are countries that haven't done a tremendous job of containing the virus. And Central America got struck by two hurricanes at the end of last year. So it's really all of the things that we kind of know about long term in terms of reasons why people might choose to, you know, emigrate and come to the United States are so much more true. You know, I was talking to people at the end of last year who were saying that what are called the push factors, if you think about migration, is what's pulling you to go to another place and what's pushing you to leave your home. Like, those push factors were at a crisis point. And between that and the sense that it's always a little bit tricky to pin down exactly how much information people have about the policies in the country they're going to. Like, most Americans don't know asylum policy in a great amount of detail. It's, you know, kind of ludicrous to think that migrants themselves would. But there is often a certain sense when a new president comes into office, with Donald Trump being the kind of exception to this, of, oh, maybe this will be a change in policy. And so you are seeing a little bit of that facilitated by misinformation from smugglers, who have every incentive in the world to say, now is your chance. You have to, you know, like, now is really when you want to take out a loan and pay me so that you can get in, because Biden's opening it up.
We're talking to Dara Lind, immigration reporter for ProPublica, about the recent increase in people crossing the southern border, what it means for those migrants and for immigration enforcement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you felt about President Biden's approach to immigration so far? What do you want to see from the Biden administration when it comes to immigration issues? What do you want to see from Congress? Are you hoping that they will take up the long-delayed issue of immigration and border security reform? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Dara Lind, immigration reporter for ProPublica, looking at an increase of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border and how that's testing the Biden administration. You can join in if you have thoughts on the issue at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Dara, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who wondered if detained immigrants were getting tested for COVID and had any kind of quarantine requirements. How is that being handled, Dara?
This has been a really big question because when it comes to people who are being processed in at the border, they're often not being held in detention. The very few people who are getting in who were enrolled in the migrant protection protocols, so-called under the Trump administration, which the Biden administration is now very slowly unraveling, those folks aren't getting detained for that long. They're getting released to, you know, nonprofit organizations. They're being allowed to reunite with family who's in the United States. And so the quarantine question is super relevant in that context. And things are a little bit tough to gauge here. The federal government isn't taking direct responsibility for testing. It's saying that, you know, it's routing FEMA money to states to, you know, help deal with the kind of testing and quarantining issue themselves. At least one governor, the governor of Texas, unsurprisingly, Governor Abbott, has said, no, we refuse this money. These families should be getting sent to ICE. They shouldn't be in our communities, and has kind of turned that into something of a political football. But more generally, it does kind of raise the dual strain that that both the government itself and nonprofits are facing when you're looking at people coming, you know, into the United States. Is you do want to, you know, you do have to take in as many people as possible as quickly as possible so that they don't languish in government custody. But at the same time, we don't have a good sense of how that is supposed to work during a pandemic because people haven't been getting in during the pandemic before. There is a kind of related problem of, you know, the ICE detention system has, like any prison system in the United States, has had kind of rampant COVID cases for the entire pandemic. Like there haven't been pandemic waves in prisons for the most part, and ICE prisons are no exception to that. Some of them have been forced to reduce their capacity because a lot of people who are in ICE custody, it's a matter of government discretion. There's no law saying they have to be. And so there have been some court orders, you know, trying to get them to release some folks. But even those decisions are often, you know, subject to interpretation or subject to slow walking. And now that it's a Democratic administration in office, there is beginning to get to be some pushback from Republican states who are arguing that the government really shouldn't be releasing anybody at all.
You mentioned earlier, Dara, smugglers are selling the message to people that this is a good time to try to cross the American border and pay those same smugglers. You write that the Biden administration is at least trying to do a PR campaign to say, in fact, no, don't come. This is not a good time. What kind of things are we seeing there?
I mean, a lot of it is just that it's part of their standard barrage of talking points on this issue, right? Roberta Jacobson, who is at the National Security Council handling U.S.-Mexican border issues, did a briefing in the White House press room today. And from the White House,
I think we've lost Dara.
Press room, she was like,
there.
Okay. Oh, have we? Sorry.
Oh, no, you're back. You cut out just for a minute. Great. So sorry. From the White House press room, you were saying. She said.
My connection just doesn't like speaking Spanish. But yeah, so Roberta Jacobson was saying, you know, La frontera está cerrada, the border is closed, which I'm sure mattered a lot to all would-be migrants who were watching C-SPAN on a weekday afternoon. But like, it is kind of, it's a fairly standard move. The Obama-Biden administration did this. The Trump administration did a certain amount of it, just using government officials to say, don't believe what you hear. It's not open. You can't come. Even in that clip you played earlier, Jen Psaki saying, you know, most of these kids will ultimately get sent back. It's not that that doesn't have any effect. It's just that it's really hard to accurately map out the landscape of where people are hearing what they're hearing from. And right now, in the midst of such uncertainty, in the midst of kind of so many changes, not just at the U.S.-Mexico border, but with other countries' mobility policies as well, it doesn't, you know, it's always a little bit ridiculous to assume that the government, that like the U.S. government is going to have perfect control over what information people decide is true. And it's, that's even more so in this, like in the current environment.
We're talking to Dara Lind, immigration reporter for ProPublica, looking at an increase in migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border and the Biden administration policy on those issues so far. Let's bring on a caller now. Keith is with us in St. Paul. Keith, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Thanks for taking my call. Well, I just want to raise an issue that I rarely hear discussed with regards to immigration, and that's that they're an important source of increasing the nation's labor pool. Most economists point to the fact that in the near future, if we're not already there, we're facing a labor shortage. So to some extent, we're cutting off our nose to spite ourselves by denying immigration to the extent that it's occurred in the past. And a related issue is the funding of the Social Security system. I would imagine thousands of your listeners think that their Social Security is some dedicated savings account from themselves, when the reality is it's that the money's that being paid in by current workers, and that money is insufficient. The system will be cutting benefits and...
Gotcha. Keith, I want to jump in because we don't have too much time left, but I take your point. And Dara, can you talk about paths to, I think the people that Keith is talking about, people wanting to come into the country and work as legally as possible and pay into things like Social Security. What is the, I don't know, the pipeline, the system looking like for them right now?
Even to the extent that those paths were available, you know, a limited number of work visas, et cetera, many of those are still subject to Trump administration proclamations from last year, severely restricting various categories of work visas in order to allow the American economy to recover from the pandemic, which is like obviously not the view of the economy that the Biden administration has, but they're still taking a relatively they're still taking a partial approach and or a slower approach to rolling all of that back. There's, for most people though, those options simply aren't available. And really, you know, a lot of people, even those who believe that there should be more of an enforcement centered approach at the U.S.-Mexico border for people coming in, you know, a lot of them will say, look, many of these people are just, you know, are primarily economic migrants. They're primarily here to work. If we expanded work path, you know, pathways for them to immigrate legally, we wouldn't have so many people, quote unquote, clogging the asylum system like this. Even kind of bracketing the question of whether or not that's true, because I think that over the last half decade, we've really seen that climate change, that institutional governance issues, a lot of things can, you know, transnational criminal organizations that aren't like the government can blur the line between when somebody is just kind of opportunistically migrating and when they're being forced to migrate. But even kind of setting that aside, that's where you really can't make policy as an executive branch. You need Congress to set visa levels. And Congress has been, for a very long time, extremely resistant to anything that would increase the pool of immigrants. So, you know, the Biden administration does have, as you mentioned, this, you know, early bill that is supposed to be a marker for what it wants to see from the immigration system. We're seeing more targeted legalization bills, and there absolutely is a push to allow essential workers, which is kind of a way in which immigrant labor has become more visible in the last year as categories of people like grocery store workers, you know, and other and health aides who were previously seen as kind of lesser forms of labor are now being recognized for, you know, how much the economy needs them to run and how much people need them. There are pushes to include them in any kind of legalization package, but it's really going to be a question of
whether immigration is an issue that the current Congress feels like tackling after the massive COVID bill that it's, you know, just passed, and the massive whatever the heck they're calling it infrastructure bill that is coming next.
In our last minute or so, Dara, obviously a long-standing issue there, but a lot of fast-moving pieces now. What are you watching for next?
I think that the Biden administration is going to be under increasing pressure to justify the continued existence of this CDC order, which is now understood to have been politically motivated by the Trump administration. And they may not have the capacity to deal with it, but it does implicate issues of a humanitarian law, because families and single adults currently aren't being allowed to seek asylum. And that is, even if they, you know, regardless of how urgent the need is, and that's going to become an issue the longer it goes on.
Dara, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dara Lind is an immigration reporter at ProPublica. She talked with us today about a rise in migration across the U.S.-Mexico border we've seen this year and what it means for the Biden administration's approach to immigration issues. Coming up, get your March Madness bracket ready, not for basketball, but for the Water Towers of Wisconsin. We'll celebrate Wisconsin's water towers and what makes them so special. A Wisconsin paper, the Sheboygan Press, is in fact doing a bracket to pick the best water tower in the state. We'll find out more coming up. You can keep track of all our conversations, big and small, here on the Ideas Network with the WPR app. You can look at our archives on the phone, listen live, check out articles and more. Just download it wherever you download your apps. And of course, you can follow us all the time over at WPR.org. Plus, your smart device in your house is able to listen to the Ideas Network, more than likely. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin folklore expert shares legends and tall tales from the state's lumberjack era. Now, here's a question for you. Which community has the best water tower in the state? I'm not talking about how well they work or how much they cost or how well built it is. I'm talking about looks. Wisconsin has quite a variety of water towers with different shapes, heights, colors, fonts, maybe a slogan, even one with a giant smiley face. In addition to pressurizing water for distribution, the towers serve as landmarks and, according to our guest, can tell stories. Anne Marie Hilton is a business reporter with the Sheboygan Press. Anne Marie, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I think a lot of us are, you know, drive by water towers. We might look at the same one day after day without thinking about them. What got you thinking about taking a closer look at them?
Yeah, well, I am one of those people, and actually from our office, we can see those three Kohler towers, and we just had a conversation one day in the newsroom just asking what is all about with these water towers.
And you looked back at the history. First of all, what do water towers do for us?
Oh, they serve a lot of purposes. For example, if there is a power outage, they hold enough water to hopefully get the city through a power outage. They keep your water pressurized, and they can be used in emergency situations such as a fire. So fire trucks can access all of that water at once quickly.
And you write that in terms of Wisconsin history, they were really markers of settlement and development in the state. Can you share a little of that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Beloit, for example, in the 1870s, they built a limestone octagonal shaped tower. And that was done because the people in the area really wanted a public water center and a place for better fire protection as well. So that and other ones similar to it are actually on the National Register of Historic Places now.
One more story you mentioned. A strange phrase appeared on a Green Bay water tower, area water tower, just before a Packers-Bears game. What went up there and how?
Yes. So a tower in Ashwaubenon actually said, "Go Bears," could be seen from Lambeau Field. And that was done because there was a Chicago-based crew who was working on the tower earlier that day. And, you know, some good rivalry fun. They thought it would be nice to paint "Go Bears" right across the front and center of the water tower.
We heard from a couple listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page about their favorites. Pete wrote Eagles Smiley Face Water Tower, and Robert wrote Whitefish Bay. It's what one of our producer Bill Martins calls a pancake water tower, a wide thing with lots of columns. What are some of the unique ones you've seen or written about around the state, Anne-Marie?
Absolutely. So there's one in Plymouth, Wisconsin, actually, that looks more like a windmill, but it used to be a water tower. And then there are two in Plover, actually. One is white with a beautiful new paint job and some clean lines. And then just in its shadow, there is one painted all black. And people who live in the area have created this little myth that they're a dueling sign of good and evil.
And that smiley face one that Pete mentioned, that's just an example of how communities try to, I don't know, sell a message about themselves. What kind of things do you see on water towers as, you know, communities use them as landmarks?
Yeah, so actually one in Kakana has two lightning bolt looking items on it. And that's a nod to their history with hydroelectricity. So not only do towns like to use the towers to add a little bit of personality, but they sometimes use it as a nod to their history as well.
Now, you have a March Madness bracket going on for Wisconsin's best water tower. It started on Monday, and I guess we're down to the final four already. Who is still in the running?
Yeah, so it's that Plymouth Tower that I mentioned that looks like a windmill, the Beloit Tower that is an octagon, and then the Kohler trio of towers, and then one in Monroe that is also a historic tower.
And if people haven't gotten in on the bracket yet, are you still taking votes, even if people weren't in it from the beginning?
Absolutely, absolutely. People can still vote.
And how do they do that?
They can find it on our website, or it's linked to your website as well, actually.
Anne-Marie, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie Hilton is a business reporter at the Sheboygan Press. We talked to her about the history, purpose, and cultural significance of the water towers of Wisconsin. If you want to vote in the semifinals and finals of the Sheboygan Press water tower bracket, you can find a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a musician and podcast host from Wauwatosa.
Joe Wong was a musical kid growing up in Wauwatosa, where he learned to play a few instruments. But he fell in love with the drums around age 11. Something just clicked with drumming that hadn't quite been there with the other instruments he'd tried.
I can remember the first time I played drums with another musician and how incredible it felt. And in some ways, I feel like I've been chasing that feeling my whole life.
After playing in bands and doing some touring, Wong enrolled at Berklee College of Music in Massachusetts, which seemed like a great idea at the time for someone who wanted to make a career out of music.
But then when I went to the school, it made me question everything and subvert my own voice, and it was a bit overwhelming. So then I kind of retreated to a farmhouse in Wisconsin to try to parse through everything and metabolize the information that I had gotten.
Wong eventually hit the road again with guitarist Marnie Stern. While on tour in New York City, he had a chance meeting with his friend and former Fugazi drummer, Brendan Canty. They grabbed drinks and got into a pretty deep conversation about music and life. And that was the spark for Wong's podcast, The Trap Set, where he talks to other drummers about a variety of topics. Canty was the show's first guest.
That's how it all started. Basically, out of my desire to work through my demons with my musical heroes.
I have a lot of work to do. I have to finish two films, and I have to have a big soundtrack job, and I just had to be working all the time. And it's like when you start drinking at night, you know, you end up spending a lot of time thinking about going out and hanging out with your friends, and it's really great and it's really fun, but you really don't get half the work done you should be.
Right.
So I hate to lay it on you, but
I thought I was feeding the muse the whole time.
I know, right? So did I.
Now, around that same time, Wong was tapped to create original music for the Netflix series Master of None, starring comedian Aziz Ansari. A friend of Wong's, who is one of the show's music directors, reached out to him, so he gave it a shot.
At the time, I was working with a partner who still lives in Milwaukee, Didier LaPlay, and so we made some demos, and Aziz and the other music supervisor, Zach Cowie, were really into what we were doing, and that's how that happened.
And that's led to composing gigs for many other series and comedy specials. And recently, Wong has taken inspiration from all of the creative people around him and channeled it into his debut album, Night Creatures, which was written as Wong's father was dying.
My dad had a massive stroke in 2010, and ultimately he never recovered. And so I saw him lose pieces of his personality over time. And that's basically what the album is about. It's my way of working through that. All things dissolve in
time. As Wong was recording the album at an LA studio, he had a surprise visitor.
I felt somebody behind me, and I turned around, and Cat Stevens was standing there. And he said, "Nice tunes," and that was enough praise to get me through the rest of the day.
Wong says he'd like to write more nice tunes in the future and find a balance between recording albums and his work as a television and film composer.
I've developed this muscle of writing a lot of material from my career as a film and TV composer, so I'm trying to deploy that muscle in service of making another album.
Joe Wong is a drummer and composer, and he hosts the podcast The Trap Set. He's a native of Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
Coming up, have you ever seen a hodag? Do you want to know what one is? We'll get a lesson in Wisconsin's lumberjack folklore from a native of Sawdust City. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. President Biden will deliver what the White House calls his first primetime address tomorrow night. We'll bring you live NPR coverage starting at 7. The address will mark 1 year since COVID-19 was declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. Join in tomorrow at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now, from tall tales to big legends, Wisconsin's got a few, including this one.
With my double blade axe and my hobnail boots, I go where the timber's tall. When there's work to be done, don't mess around, just sing right up for Paul.
Hey, Paul!
I'm coming, boys!
Paul Bunyan! Paul Bunyan! He's 63 axe handles high, with his feet on the ground and his head in the sky. Hey, Paul! Hey, Paul Bunyan!
The heyday of the lumberjack era in the state gave rise to a lot of folklore and mythology, strange woodland creatures, supernatural feats of strength, and someone who's been investigating and gathering these tales is Chad Lewis, a paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer from Eau Claire. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Greetings from the Northwoods.
You're in the Northwoods now. You are from Sawdust City, originally Eau Claire, a strong connection to the lumber industry. Can you talk about the importance of timber to the city and the state as a whole?
Yes. Well, of course, Eau Claire was known as Sawdust City because of all the lumber mills we had in our town. And we weren't alone. Almost every city along a river had one or more sawmills. And those sawmills fed the lumber industry, but also many other industries, broom making, tools. I think today many people forget how important the lumber industry was to shaping not only Wisconsin, but the entire country.
And you're giving a virtual talk this evening for the Shawano Public Library about the legends that came out of this. How big a source of our folklore and legend was lumberjacking here in the state?
It's amazing. Charles E. Brown, the late, great Wisconsin folklorist, wrote in the early 1900s about Paul Bunyan stories. And imagine you work from the time when it's too dark to see until you can't see at night. And all you could do is come back to the bunkhouse, sit around in your bunk with all the other lumberjacks and spin tall tales and tell yarns. So that's what they did for their entertainment, trying to one-up each other on who could tell the best tale. And that really grew a whole myth of monsters, legends, and just craziness in the Northwoods where anything could happen.
Well, one tale that kept growing bigger and bigger in the telling was Paul Bunyan and his big blue ox, Babe, kind of a well-known figure. I think Minnesota has some claim to him, too. Are there parts of that legend that people might not be as familiar with?
Yes, of course, we claim in Wisconsin to be the home of Paul Bunyan, but so does Minnesota, Michigan, Vermont, the country of Canada, and a few other states. But we all know Paul was from Wisconsin. And most people don't know how Paul met Babe. And he actually met Babe in the terrible winter of the blue snow. And it was blue snow because it was so cold that everybody was cursing up a blue streak, and it turned all the snow blue. It was so cold that winter that fish grew fur. That's how cold it was when Paul found Babe in the snow. And he had already turned blue from the blue snow, so Paul took him into his lumber camp. And like everything around Paul Bunyan, Babe grew to an enormous size, and the two went on to make history.
And that speaks to, I think, some of the creativity of the people in this line of work and probably others. The it was so cold, how cold was it sort of things you just came up with. We rely on, you know, professionals create stuff for us. Back then, it might have been just people sitting around in that lumber shack.
And no two Paul Bunyan or lumberjack stories were the same. They were always changing, always morphing, progressing, and I think getting a little bit better. And oftentimes that was the creativity of the lumberjack, especially when the greenhorns, the rookies, came into the lumber camp. They would try to scare them or initiate them by telling the weirdest tales they could.
And now you mentioned the monsters that were invented. Now, the Hodag is a famous one. I know that was kind of invented for publicity purposes. I think we've talked to you about the Hodag before. Chad, remind us of the story of the Hodag. And was it a big lumber one?
It was. Back in the 1800s, Eugene Shepherd out of Rhinelander area went into the woods and saw this hideous monster that looked somewhat like a dragon, a huge beast with spikes down its back, huge claws, long fangs, and he eventually captured this Hodag and brought it to the Rhinelander area, put it on display at carnivals and county fairs until people found out it was a hoax. And then he admitted that he hoaxed it, but he said the only reason he hoaxed it was because he wasn't able to capture it. It was so dangerous out in the woods. And believe it or not, more people showed up to see how he had hoaxed it than when they thought it was real. And the town of Rhinelander now embraces it. It's their sporting team mascot. They have a huge display of the Hodag out in front of their visitors bureau. So it's a fun tale.
Talking to Chad Lewis, folklore and paranormal researcher. He's doing a talk on Lumberjack Legends of Wisconsin online for the Shawnee Public Library tonight. Chad, the Hodag wasn't the only creature out there, was it? What other kind of things did lumberjacks scare the greenhorns with?
One of my favorites is the snow snake. Unlike other snakes, this snake hibernates all summer long. It only comes out after the first snow. It migrated here years ago from Siberia, and it's pure white, so you can't see it on the snow. So it would bite you and you would die, but not from the poisonous venom. You would freeze to death. And there was only one antidote, one cure for the bite from a snow snake, and that was huge amounts of liquor. So much that they recommended that by the time you're falling off of your bar stool and you're seeing things, you're probably in the clear from the snow snake.
I'm going to go out on a limb, Chad, and say there were some lumberjacks who took the treatment, what do they call it, prophylactically, in advance of that snow snake bite, if you take my meaning.
Well, that's the beauty, is a lot of these lumber camps, alcohol was not allowed. So it was a big deal. So I think a lot of them probably invented getting bit by the snow snake. And as you said, some of them probably took the aspirin before the headache.
Now, do you have a favorite story from Lumberjack legend outside of course, the Paul Bunyan legend?
I do. And my favorites are the real stories of the lumberjacks. And one of my interests in the lumberjack era was when these men died. And it was always the men, because the men would leave for the winter and go into these lumber camps. And many of them were farmers. And it was the most dangerous job in America. Mm. Imagine these huge trees, but then also bringing it down to the rivers, waiting for the snow melt, and then putting them in the water and bringing them down to the lumber towns. So a lot of the lumberjacks died. And if they were lucky, they would be buried in a barrel or a couple big pieces of bark around them as a makeshift coffin, and they'd be buried in the ground. Others would then just have their boots tied to a tree. They would nail their boots up to a tree of someone who had died. So if you're ever out in the woods or along a riverbank and you see boots nailed to a tree, it might be a lumberjack. But I love those stories because many of these people were unknown. They didn't get a funeral service. They didn't get a proper burial. They might not even known their name. They might have just went by Madison Mike or something of that nature. So I'm fascinated how both the real folklore melds with the not so real folklore.
And you're Chad Lewis, so I got to ask, are there paranormal stories, ghostly hauntings and things like that associated with the lumberjack era?
Well, the lumberjacks reported a lot of what we would consider today to be Bigfoot sightings. They didn't call it Bigfoot back then, of course, but they talked about these hairy, giant creatures roaming the woods. And back in those days, the big woods had endless possibilities. If you believed, you know, the Hodag was running around, why couldn't this giant gorilla type thing be running around? So I'm still finding more and more real reports, at least the reports were real, of Bigfoot type creatures. They also believed in the Willow of the Wisp, these balls of light, swamp gases, we might call them, that would plague a lumber camp during the summer months as well.
Why do you enjoy sharing these stories of Wisconsin's folklore and legends past with new generations, Chad?
One, they're amazingly fun. They're just so much fun to research and to add your own spin to them. But two, it keeps the lumber era alive in our memory of how much this played in Wisconsin's industry and how it shaped the lives of so many people. So many men were able to buy their farms and their property from working the winters in the lumber camps. And I think that's a history that should not be forgotten. It's only 100 years ago, but yet most people, we have no clue about it.
And the talk you're giving tonight is free to the public, and people don't have to go to Shawano. I think it is just online. How could people find you if they want to watch?
Best way is just go to the Shawano County Library website. And if you can't make it tonight, I believe they're recording it, and it will be available on their website as well.
And give us a sneak preview, Chad. You're talking about lumberjack legends tonight. What are you researching right now, maybe for future talks?
I'm doing finishing up a book on supernatural dares, where places that have a supernatural reputation where you have to do something for the legend to come true, like sit in the devil's chair or knock three times on a cursed mausoleum to release the spirit. All these things that you got to test your bravery to go do.
That sounds fun. We'll talk to you about it, I'm sure. Chad, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Keep an eye out.
Wisconsin's own Chad Lewis is a paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer. We talked to them today about some of Wisconsin's lumberjack era folklore. It's a taste of a longer program he's giving tonight as a virtual event through the Shawano Public Library. We've got a link to the library's Facebook page up at WPR.org/Central Time. They'll stream the talk for free via Facebook Live at 6 p.m. today. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, get the latest news on vaccinations and who can get them, and recommendations on how to stay safe as those vaccines continue to roll out. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and from Wisconsin Public Radio. And then it's the week in Washington with a look at the COVID-19 relief bill. It just passed Congress today, waiting for signature from President Biden, possibly as soon as the end of this week. And remember, you can hear President Biden here on Wisconsin Public Radio tomorrow night, his first prime time address, marking the anniversary of the declaration of COVID-19 as a global pandemic. Listen to that here on the Ideas Network or WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.